This is KJ Live. With Chris Johnson. And Chris is having conversations with influencers in the sports world and entertainment industry. Now here's Chris Johnson.
This is KJ Live. Today's guest on the show is a senior NBA writer, film producer, and former chair of the National Association of Black Journalists. As an NBA senior NBA writer for the Undefeated, ESPN's digital platform that focuses on the intersection of race, sports, and culture, Spears regularly breaks NBA news and publishes long-form content pieces on some of the league's most intriguing subjects. Our guest has also covered the NBA for more than 20 years, including 18 NBA All-Star Games and the 2008 Beijing Olympics. The San Jose State and LSU graduate has also produced Katrina Kopp in the Superdome, an award-winning documentary chronicling the experiences of New Orleans police officer Rhett Charles and other city residents during their stay in the Louisiana Superdome after Katrina. Please welcome to KJ Live, the legend, Mark J. Spears is in the building, y'all. What's up, Mark?
What's up, bro? What's up, man?
Man, I'm chilling, man.
Y'all Bruins hurt my heart the other day, man.
We had to get y'all.
Hey, you see, I didn't even like, I just said, you got us. You know what I mean? I didn't even like try to act tough about it.
Well, that was our Super Bowl, man. Anytime you get a chance to play like an LSU to kind of get your season catapulted, bro, we came. Yeah. All the stars got aligned, man. It was just a testament to like us really being up for the game, bro. But you know, your coach was talking stuff too. That was
you know what he yeah he did that.
But he's a Trojan. He got some Trojan ties, so I understand.
But you know what he was feeling himself a little bit. I didn't too much like that. But you know I got it was interesting that day in L.A. My two schools, San Jose State, lost to USC.
Jeez.
Gave with their coach's last win before he got fired. And then LSU lost. And I was supposed to go down there because you hit me. You're like, yo, yeah. You coming? And I'm like, nah, man, that's too many people to be around right now. And I blame COVID, but
yeah,
I'm glad I ain't go.
Oh, man, nah, it was good.
Although I would have had fun seeing y'all. Yeah, I would have fun with y'all.
Man, it was good times. But man, you just came back from the Hall of Fame, where you kind of hosted the whole situation out there, man. Talk about how special it was. This is your second time doing it. Talk about how special the opportunity was and how special this Hall of Fame class that's going inducted is.
Well, I mean, you know, these guys are our era, right? These are dudes like we might have played against, you know, and perhaps it's getting to the end of our era. So it's certainly been a special year because you got to remember the class of 2020 was delayed because of COVID. So I had the, you know, the honor to host it in the spring. That was Kobe.
Yeah.
You know, I miss him, man. I wish he was here. Just, I could only imagine what kind of Hall of Fame speech that was, but to be able to be the host of that press conference in the spring, and I covered Kevin Garnett when he played for the Celtics. So KG gave me this, you know what I mean? Like, that was,
yes, sir.
From him, that's a lot of respect, you know, KG.
Yeah.
You know? And then, you know, it was just Tim Duncan was in that class too. So that was certainly a special class. And I think even with this class, these were guys that I knew even better. Like, I've spent a lot of time with Ben Wallace recently. Doing this piece, man, I don't know if you got to see it with the Undefeated. Our video team did it. We went back to Alabama went deep with him. And so, like, Ben, during a press conference, man, he came up to me and hugged me before he answered questions, and he was in tears. He was emotional, man. He was emotional the whole weekend. C. Webb came up to me, gave me some love, gave me a hug. You know, I remember being at Arco, interviewing him with the Kings when he was probably at the height of his career. And then Pierce, I covered him when he won a championship. And, you know, me and him been friends for a while. And that's my dude, man. He's crazy. he's that crazy dude in a good way, though, man. Like, he don't hold
Inglewood.
You want to know how Paul feels? Ask him. You want to know what's going on?
Ask him.
He'll tell you. And if you his people,
yes, sir.
He loved you, man. So it was beautiful to be a part of that class. I think my only thing that was kind of sad was when they said that Russell was gonna get in for coaches and getting it going to Hall of Fame for the second time, I was so excited about the opportunity to interview Russell in the press conference. But because of COVID, he canceled a couple things. And he, one of the things he canceled was not doing the press conference. So that was like, I obviously miss Kobe, and I didn't get the chance to interview Russell, but the rest of the press conference was amazing. The weekend was amazing. You know, it was good to see LeBron in the building during the Hall of Fame and show respect to Chris Bosh. It was great to see Jordan in the building, and then also to see Russell on stage. Yeah. Like, how often do you see, you know, LeBron, Jordan, and Russell all in the same place? And I don't know what happened behind the scenes. I would assume that as soon as Jordan was done sitting next to Tony Kukoc, he was in a PJ or the casino in Springfield right afterwards. One of the two,
Most likely.
And LeBron just, if I was a betting man, the reason why Chris Bosh was last and Paul Pierce wasn't, who's like a Celtics legend, was because I think they were timing LeBron's arrival. Because all of a sudden, he just showed up like, oh, LeBron's here at the end, right?
Wow. Oh, out of nowhere? Oh, I didn't know that. Okay, so he just popped in.
Like, why was Bosh last? Like, and then all of a sudden, LeBron showed up like, come on, man. Like, LeBron's pretty powerful.
There go Bron again.
My boy Rob Luna from, you know, Rob, the security guru from the Lakers was there. So I was like, okay. I know what's happening tonight, but you know, how often do you get to see those three guys in the same room?
And that's what I was gonna kind of touch on, Mark. When you take us back, man, to the origins of everything, when you first wanted to be a sports writer, did you ever think that you was gonna be in a room with Jordan, Russell, Bron on the stage, introducing folks at the Hall of Fame? Like, talk about the foundation of it all, how it started for you, and you know what I'm saying?
It's interesting you say that, because I knew I wanted to be a sports writer since I was in the seventh grade. But you got to remember, like, bro, when we were coming up, like, the internet was wearing diapers. Like, I remember when I was at South Bay State and they're like, yo, we got to give you this email. Like, what in the hell is an email? Yeah. And they're like, so you could send somebody a message on the computer.
Same with me.
I'm like, why not just call them? Like, I have a cell phone there. I can page them.
Page me, baby. Oh, you remember pages.
So my point is, like, I really got into this to be a print reporter. I didn't go to school for television. I didn't go to school for radio. Yeah. I thought it was dope to just have my name in a newspaper. Internet wasn't around, but, you know, I first started dreaming about being a sports writer in the seventh grade. We had a career day at Sylvandale Junior High School in San Jose. And, bro, I swear to God, one of my teachers must have been dating some dude from the Warriors, right? Because San Jose is like a good, like, 40 miles from Oakland. That traffic bad in the morning. So the Warriors came to our junior high and spoke. And he was one of the people that spoke. So I went to listen to him. I'm like, I'm going to get a free jersey, free tickets, bumper sticker, something, basketball. Mm-hmm. He ain't had nothing.
None.
Right, so when I speak to kids, I try to give them something out because I remember that. But for some reason, he pointed at me and he goes, well, what do you want to do when you grow up? And this is what I said. I want to play for y'all. And he said, well, I'm not going to say that you can't, but if you don't make it to the NBA, what are you going to do? And I said, well, I don't know. And I remember, because I was reading Sports Illustrated in elementary school, my dad got me a subscription because of how much I love sports. And I remember seeing this stat that said less than 2% of all college basketball players made it to the NBA. And I was this realistic kid now. Like, I was like, dang, like, less than 2%? That's so my mom was playing in college, not playing in the NBA. But that stat was in my mind. But the guy turned to me and said, well, my advice to you, young man, is if you could find a career where you combine what you love most in life with what you do best in school, you'll have a job that you'll be happy to be in every day. That was hell of an advice, right? So my teacher, Miss Thompson, the next day, she said we had to write somebody, write a letter. There wasn't no email yet, right?
Yeah.
We had actually write a letter to somebody we were in a, interested in, in a field that we were interested in. So I wrote a columnist by the name of Mark Purdy from the San Jose Mercury News and asked him, how can I be a sports writer? He wrote me back, sent me a letter, and told me how to be a sports writer. In the seventh grade, he gave me basically a Bible, a roadmap from seventh grade through college on what to do to be a sports writer.
So let me ask you this. So, Mark, for people out there, aspiring sports writers right now, can you share some of the secrets of this Bible or just the basic foundation of it?
Yeah. No, he told me to write. This was all in the letter, right on the school paper now.
Mm-hmm.
So if you go in the Silverdale Junior High library somewhere, my first job, I tell people, is I covered the Silverdale Junior High Bears 8th grade flag football team. I was going to their practice. I was writing stories for the school paper while I was in the 7th grade. He said, when you go to high school, take all the typing classes you could take, which probably was the most valuable thing I did in high school was take typing classes. Took typing 1, 2, and 3. He said, either join the school yearbook or the school newspaper. I joined the school newspaper. We had a guy from the San Jose Mercury News who ran our school paper, came in once a week. His name was he was a writer named Mick Van Valkenburg. So I got to touch an actual writer from the San Jose Mercury News. And then Mr. Purdy said at the end, he said, when you go to college, take as many internships as possible and also, you know, write on the school paper. So I chasing the college basketball dream. I went to 3 different schools, but you know how crazy our lives are. I still wrote on the school paper every single year. I did internships every single year. San Jose Metro for free. Grand Rapids Press. Dallas Morning News. Was an intern with the National Association of Black Journalists. So I wasn't drafted in the NBA, but by the time I graduated from San Jose State, I felt like I was a first-round draft pick in being a sports writer. And a lot of that, I give credit to Mark Purdy for writing me that letter that, you know, basically gave me a roadmap and lit a fire.
So at what point, because you hooped in college, at what point did you just say, you know what, I'm not tripping on hooping no more. I'm literally going to focus all my attention on becoming a sports writer. Or were you doing both?
From the day I showed up.
Did you get a scholarship, Mark?
So this is, we'll go back. I graduated from Andrew Hill High School in San Jose. I was a pretty damn good high school basketball player. I wasn't KJ, you know what I'm saying? But I did get the better of one of your guys, Chris Dempsey.
Ooh. Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah.
6'6 post?
So, he used to go to Bellarmine College Prep. Transferred to schools in San Jose called Santa Teresa. Yeah. I was a senior. He was a junior, and I heard about this bad white boy with hops.
Oh, he was bad. Kevin was bad. KD is one of the before he hurt his back.
Yeah.
So
okay, he's like a big time chef now. He gonna hear this story. He gonna be mad. But the first time we played him, I turned into the post, and I put the ball in the glass, and he batted my shot out the glass, bro.
He beat it.
I was like, oh, okay, this dude can play. He's for real. Like,
Then
I started bodying them, and we beat them. I think we beat them twice, man. Like,
oh, the body? Yeah, you can't hang with the body, bro.
Demps didn't like too much physical, and I was that kind of player. I was like you. We were physical boys.
Oh, but, that's funny.
You know, I averaged 16 and 15 in high school. I think my best game I had Piedmont Hills. I had 32 points and 22 rebounds or something like that.
On the glass.
Yeah. No, I had a 22-24 game. But my grades were bad. I broke my leg my sophomore year in high school, so that held me back a lot. I had 2 great players that were seniors my junior year, so I was like behind them. So it wasn't until AAU before my senior year that people even really knew who I was. But the one thing that really, you know, and I was like all league, I was third in MVP vote, and I was really proud of that because the two guys ahead of me, a guy named Terry Martin, who played at Iona, and a guy named Brian Bell, who played at Chico, they were on the team that won the league, and our league finished in fifth. So I was like, if I'm third in MVP and our team finished in fifth in our league, that's a compliment from the
– That's a compliment.
Yeah. Coaches. And so I played in what is called the Central Section – Central Coast Section All-Star Game, man, with which basically is from San Francisco through the peninsula, through San Jose, all the way to Monterey. And that was a big honor for me. I played in the Pump Classic, Unsigned Seniors Classic. Brent Berry played in that. I remember that. Columbia University wanted me. Ivy League school, best journalism program in the country.
Now, your grades. Now, could you say you had bad grades, but then you had worked on them to get to the point where Columbia was rocking with you or what?
No, this is they ain't seen my transcript yet.
Oh.
I said they wanted me.
Hey. Yeah.
They had a coach from San Jose State that went and become an assistant there.
Okay.
Eric Sawney. And I got a good call, too. He reached out to me recently, and he wanted me to come.
Yeah.
I had a 2.2 GPA, man.
Man, that's tough.
I had a 2.2 GPA, and at Eastside.
They couldn't pull no strings?
And they were, no, Ivy League school.
I
know. That's when I woke up. That's when I woke up. I'm still crushed by that.
Yeah.
I didn't get a good I got bad advice going into, like, I went to a high school where there were a lot of kids who were like Section 8 kids that lived across the street. And my family was, I call it lower middle class. I didn't have the newest, but I had clothes, I had food, right? You get it. But I didn't realize that I needed a certain GPA to go to college. Nobody told me that in the beginning. And so when I found out, it was too late, man. I had all these C's because they said you had needed a 2.0 to be eligible. And so Columbia wanted me. I didn't have the grades. I got recruited by several different schools. San Jose State at that time was trying to get me to walk on. But I ended up going to junior college. And I went to Foothill College in Los Altos Hills, California, which was called the Harvard on the Hill because their academics were really good. And a lot of the students there ended up going to Stanford or even Ivy League schools.
Stuff
and
like
I was
that.
Like, woke. I was woke up then, realized I wasn't going to the NBA. I was using college to pay for school and I love basketball. And I just remember, man, that first day of class, they brought us in. They like the set person to your right and left. They're not going to graduate. Like, and it
by
scared
the percentages,
me. I got scared straight. I think I was on the dean's list the first semester. I never made the dean's list again because I figured out
how to move. Yeah.
But I was just always at when I played, went there for 2 years, Foothill College, and I went to a Division II HBCU. I was supposed to go to Tuskegee, committed there, and then the coach got fired. So I ended up going to another HBCU in DC called the District of Columbia. Played there for a season. The academics were horrible. I ended up having a great second half of the season, scored 32 in what would be my last college basketball game. But the coach there, I remember him, Ed Epps, God rest his soul. He told me, man, if you cared about basketball as much as you do that goddamn journalism, you'd be a hell of a player.
Mm.
And so I'm like, coach, if the NBA was interesting to me, I wouldn't be here.
Make no mistake about it, coach.
Yeah,
make
I
no
was
mistake.
Realistic, man. Like, I wouldn't be playing at UDC, coach. You know what I'm saying? And I ended up leaving there and transferring to San Jose State, and then it got crazy.
And so you graduated from San Jose State. What was your first gig as far as being a sports writer professionally? Your very first
So
one?
My first job, I covered Arkansas's football and basketball team for the
what
Tulsa World.
This? What year was
95.
It? 95. Wow.
So, I think y'all just beat them.
Yo, yes. They had just won a championship in 94, right?
No, in 93, right?
No, I think it was because they beat
No, Duke. No, yes. They won in 94 and they lost to y'all in 95.
Yeah.
Right?
Okay, so that's the era? Okay.
So when I came in, Corliss was gone. Scottie Thurman was gone. Like all these dudes had left to the NBA.
And
I used to be on campus and people would be like, Corliss, Corliss. I'm like, I'm not Corliss Williamson. You know, you got to remember.
You had the baldy?
No, I had a short haircut, same height, you know what I'm saying, same kind of build. Like, you know, all black people look like, Corliss, Corliss.
I know.
I'm prettier than Corliss now. I'm like, stop. But I
was Arkansas culture shock for you?
Well, Tulsa was because I basically lived in Tulsa, and I just went up for football games and practices. So I lived in Tulsa. Actually, Tulsa is closer to Fayetteville, Arkansas, than it is Norman, Oklahoma, where University of Oklahoma is. So I would drive up. I'd go to all the football games, which was, I mean, like I covered the SEC out of college, which is not normal for kids out of college, especially at that time, especially a black kid for that matter.
Yeah.
And, but I got Nolan Richardson, man. Yeah. My first job, I was covering Nolan, which was to this day, one of the greatest things I've ever done in my career, to spend 2 years with Nolan Richardson. And he took me under his wing, man, and really looked out for me. And it was like, after that, why do I need to be intimidated covering any coach? I covered Nolan. He was as strong a personality as anybody, any coach that I've ever been around.
Right. Mark, let me ask you this particularly about Nolan. Do you think that time covering him for the Tulsa World, do you think that shaped sort of like the direction you would, the direction you went with things you were interested in? Like, so like, for instance, the Undefeated, some of the things that you cover and the long form content that you present, or I won't say taboo subjects, but they're of the racial nature, and they're stuff you just don't see nowhere else really people talking about. You covered Dirk and Whiskey's interracial marriage. I mean, you just touch on things that, you know, kind of people will think about. Do you think the time with Nolan Richardson kind of helped shape that narrative, or were you already that way?
I mean, I give Nolan is my guy, but that started from childhood, man. Like just... dealing with racism my family dealt with. Like my mom, she couldn't go to nursing school in New Orleans that she wanted to go to because, and this was a Catholic school, because she was black. So she ended up having to go to a nursing school in St. Louis, Missouri, where she met my father, because it was to go to all black nursing school so she could follow her dream of being a nurse. My dad in the 90s, early 90s, worked for New United Motors, which was basically where Tesla manufacturer is in Fremont, California, in the Bay, and won a racism lawsuit because him and a bunch of other black managers were training white people, and the white people were getting promoted over them after they learned the trade. So, you know, as a kid, sadly, I dealt with a lot of racism from people of all races. I grew up around a lot of Mexicans. I grew up around a lot of Asians. I had a basketball coach who, my freshman and sophomore year, took me to a Mexican restaurant. He goes, you know, there ain't fried chicken in there, right? You know, watermelon in there. And this is my coach. And talking to a kid like that. Yeah. I remember I went into a Vietnamese restaurant once just on a hot day to get a soda. And the man went in the back and came back and gave me a cup of piss. Like, so there was stuff I was dealing with like my whole life. But, you know, my mom used to be a part of this Black Nurses Association in San Jose. And we used to go to the Afro-American Center in San Jose. And I had to find time to waste time. So I would go into the film room. I'm like 10 and Eyes on the Prize is on. That amazing award-winning documentary where it basically talked about the civil rights movement. And I learned everything about Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, black folks getting bit by dogs, the white fountains, the black fountains, the civil rights marches and all that stuff and all these, you know, horrible deaths and lynchings. And I'm like 10 years old learning all this stuff, watching these movies. And it just had an impression on me. And I think what was valuable about my college education is it allowed me to, it's one thing to speak out, but it's another thing to know what you're saying and you know how to say it eloquently. And I think that, you know, college certainly helped prepare me and help me to think out my thoughts before I say them and be more factual and less emotional. And so I think all these things, when this job opened with the Undefeated, like, there were some Black journalists that were scared to have that job. Like, this is like several years before George Floyd. Like, do you want to go out there and talk about race? You know, this is pre-Trump, right? And you still got people then like, ain't no racism. What are you talking about? Ain't no racism. And there were a lot of people that didn't like what I was writing. I'm writing about the, you know, there's so many stories about the lack of Black people playing baseball. Okay, I'm going to write about the lack of white players in the NBA, which was factual. Mm-hmm. Like, talk about racist issues. Talk about what it's like to be Black playing for the Utah Jazz. Talk about the elephant in the room. And I've enjoyed that, this road. I've enjoyed working there. And obviously when the previous president was there, there was probably a lot more fire that it showed that the racism issues in this country, the pain of Black people, the pain of people of all colors, and people like, yo, because they were hating on the Undefeated at first, but now they're like, we should have had this long ago. This is necessary. Then you've seen places like the New York Times, the LA Times, different websites, New York Times, like follow up and get some kind of Undefeated kind of like jobs. And so I'm honored that Kevin Merida and Raina Kelly hired me to be a part of this, because this is like the greatest job that I've ever had, because it's bigger than basketball and writing about who was traded or, you know, the next trend on your jump shot. No, I'm like telling stories about real life and pain and racism that these players have dealt with, and telling their stories, like having just told the Ben Wallace story recently, and he used to pick cotton and go to school with no shoes on. Like, Ben Wallace been out of the league for over 5 years, and Ben Wallace started playing this in the league in 96, but you never heard that story. You know, so I'm blessed with the ability to have a job and comfort from a lot of NBA players, that they will open up and release their pain to me. And I take a lot of pride and I take a lot of care in that.
Yeah, as you should. Mark, when we talk about the subject of Black coaches and Black executives in the NBA, it starts, you know, it's kind of one of those topics where it's like, who would you rather have, a Black executive or a Black head coach? Because the Black executive, you know, is more, maybe more likely to hire a Black head coach, et cetera. When you look at that conversation, what are your thoughts on that? What's the level of importance of hiring a Black executive in the NBA versus a Black head coach?
I want a Black owner. The Black owner is the owner is the one that controls all of that, right? Because even if you're the general manager or the president or whatever, ultimately it's the ownership that decides what you want to do. You could have a bunch of great ideas, but if the owner of the company says, nah,
then
hey, what about this guy, James Garfinkel? I like him. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You know, it's important that even if you're in a position of power, that you're able to implement what you want to do. And so I do think, though, sadly, being realistic, you know, Michael Jordan's the only owner. We're not, Black folks ain't owning teams. People of color aren't really starting to own some teams, you know, Nets, Kings. I think, though, that these owners are starting to realize, it's kind of interesting you're seeing this with like Deion Sanders too, how Black athletes are responding to Black executives and Black coaches, right? Now, I think there's, if I'm not mistaken, 15 to 17 coaches of color in the league. More than half the coaches in the league are of color now, which is amazing.
It is.
You know, we have also have a Hispanic coach and a Latinx coach in Charlotte and a Asian coach in Miami. We got to remember that too. Like, and like when you hear Devin Booker and DeAndre Ayton saying that having a black general manager who used to play in the league, having a black coach that used to play in the league, makes an it helps me out because I could feel like I could communicate with them better, right? Like, ultimately, I think change happens when I hate to say it, like when the players got to speak out more, man. Like,
you think
if they are impacted by, you know, having more black coaches and executives, then they got to say it or like it won't happen. I remember having a conversation with an all-star who I'll leave nameless about, are you involved in who your team is hiring for president? Oh, man, I don't want to get involved in that. I'm like, you're the star. They'll listen to you. You have power to at least get somebody black in the building. I mean, doesn't mean like the white dude ain't the best person for the job, right? But at least get us in the building and let us convince them that we are the best person for the job. That's what I think hopefully happens from now on, is a true ability to show that we are the most qualified, that we are the best fit. That doesn't mean like it cancels white America from coaching the black player. If the white coach is the best guy, hire him. But if the black woman is the best person for the job, hire her. You know what I mean? And hopefully, you know, you got these mostly old school conservative owners in this league, but they want success.
Right.
In the same way, they don't look at color. The only color they see with money is green. Right. If that black dude is going to help them win games and help their players respond.
Yeah.
If that, you know, woman is, then I think they're going to ultimately decide, kind of like when Alabama started getting black football players, like we want to win.
Yeah. Yeah.
I want to make money. So if the black man or this woman could get us there the best, then that's who I want to hire. And if that's the case, then, hey, man, bro, that's what all we should ask for, right, is a fair shake. Don't hire me just because I'm black. Hire me because I'm the best. And oftentimes we don't have an opportunity to show that we are the best for the job. But it's starting to change a little bit.
It is. I think the opportunity to show is the most important thing, the foot in the door. I guess I wanted to get from you was, and obviously the player that you mentioned remains nameless, but do you feel like some of the sentiment that he shared, you think most of the all-star caliber players in the NBA outside of, you know, obviously the outspoken ones that we know about, you think a lot of them feel that way? They don't want to speak up? They don't want to ruffle feathers?
I think that a lot of them don't realize their power, right? Or they're too young to really understand what influence that they could have. A lot of times you don't realize it till you're older in your career and you don't have that power anymore. You don't have that kind of influence anymore. I mean, obviously in Brooklyn, you know, Durant and Kyrie had power to influence the hiring of Nash. Right. I'm sure, respectfully, I say this, LeBron James had influence on who gets on that staff. Like, I'm sure Fizdale is there for a reason. Right.
Absolutely.
But I'm sure he had influence on who the head coach is going to be. Like, but he understands his power, he understands his strength. Chris Paul is close with, you know, Monty and with James Jones. So that played an influence on him wanting to go to Phoenix and wanting to stay
in Phoenix.
In Phoenix. He could have left. He could have left. But I do think that oftentimes when you're a 22, 23, 24-year-old dude and we're in this world where we got more money than we ever thought we were going to make, you're not really thinking about how the, you know, the bread is made and how you can influence that. Because you can't tell me that, like, if Steph Curry goes into a room, that he can't tell the Warriors front office, we need more black representation here. We need more people of color here. You know what I mean?
Absolutely he can. Absolutely.
Yeah. Like, every superstar has that ability to make an impact. And I do think that, you know, hey, look, man, I could beat the ground all the time about the lack of black coaches and executives. You do the same. But ultimately, we're not making a decision.
Yes.
But I know, like, when LeBron was in Cleveland, boy, they were walking on eggshells both times he was there. When it came time for him to make a decision about his future, he had power there. All these players have power, but will they exercise their ability to use it? But when they lose that power, and here's another thing that these guys got to think about. They think they're going to play forever. And they're not. But then when you look at a lot of these coaches, they're not former players. So if you fight for former players to get these jobs now,
you open up that pipeline.
You open up the pipeline and potentially open up the ability for you to have that job when you're done.
And that's what I'm saying.
Then they're not thinking like that. They're thinking today. The one best thing they have done, the players have done, I think, in the last 10 years in terms of the future, was getting medical insurance. Mm-hmm. Your father, who played in the league over 10 years, right?
Yep.
He and his wife and his young daughter, I mean, you good.
Yeah.
But they got the best of medical insurance the rest of their
very
life.
Very good medical insurance. Yes.
The best of medical insurance.
Yes.
Right?
Premium. That premium.
So that's something that Chris Paul did that was amazing, right?
That's awesome.
It was get that. But they got to remember, like, the same way you want to, which is good with the minimum contracts in terms of letting veterans stay in the league longer by paying half their salary. Mm-hmm. Start getting, we shouldn't see Jerry Stackhouse at Vanderbilt. He should be coaching in the NBA, mm-hmm. right? We shouldn't see.
What about Juwan?
Juwan should be coaching.
Patrick.
He played it. He paid his dues.
How
does Patrick Ewing not get a chance? Right. But you see a lot of coaches, and this is with all due respect, who've never played one game in the league, who've gotten opportunities. And I'm not saying they didn't pay their dues and get their opportunities, but the players, you got to protect this league for you in the future, too. And I've seen players who have big names that can't get in. I remember telling Robert Pack,
yeah,
we had this big debate about whether he should coach in the G League or not as an assistant. And I said, Rob, just get in the door, man. Just get in the door and see what happens. And then Rob ended up getting in the door, ended up making it to the NBA. We got to get him back in as a coach because he was at the Washington staff. But a lot of NBA players don't want to do that.
No, they don't want to put their foot in the door, the start at the ground floor type of role. But yeah. The ones do, they ascend the ranks pretty quickly, Mark. I've seen the ones that are willing to grind, they rise in the ranks pretty quickly.
Yeah. And then they might feel like Kenyon Martin, who I think has a tremendous basketball mind. Oh, he's too tough, too crazy. You know, God bless the Nuggets for giving him an opportunity this summer, but he needs to be a coach. Rasheed Wallace, we'll let him go to Memphis. Bonzi Wells, he'll go to some NA. Like, they were young guys with a lot of power but you can't tell me that those guys can't come into the NBA and help somebody.
What's interesting is that the guys you just named, from Sheed to Bonzi to who else did you name? You named somebody, but they
Kenny
all
Martin.
Three. Kmart, all three are like, we're in the league. We're like fiery, tough dudes.
Yeah.
Didn't take no shit. You know, those type of cats. So it's like, you think cats are afraid to bring a dude like that in at the helm?
Yeah.
Or bring you in on the staff because of that influence?
In any capacity.
Yeah.
Like, I think one of the great under the radar hirings this summer was Nick Van Exel being hired by Atlanta.
No, I love it for Trey.
Like, yeah. Quick. Now, Quick was an asshole when he played for the Nuggets. And I love him, and he respects this. He will tell you that he – can I say that? I'm sorry.
Yeah, you can. Yeah.
He was an asshole.
Yeah.
he was tough to deal with. Hey, he had a big ego, but he was a bad ball player now. You saw it in L.A. He got buckets.
Absolutely. He's one of the coldest. He got great assists.
And if it wasn't for, like, a guy named maybe John Stockton, perhaps we would be – and Gary Payton, we would be talking about Nick more.
Right.
But Nick was an amazing – dynamic score and passer. So now, how can we bring Trae Young to the next level? They brought Quick in. And I think Quick perhaps was held back as a coach a little bit because of the past. Man, he's a totally different dude. This dude is more worried about his coffee, how much sugar he got in it, because he liked cold brew coffee than
that's so funny. Club. That was so 20, funny.
He ain't 20 no more.
Yeah.
But Quick's basketball mind is brilliant.
Right.
And Atlanta was smart enough to realize that maybe Travis Schlink knows him from Quick's days in Golden State, the Quick time he had with the Warriors.
Mm-hmm.
How could I bring Trey up? Let me bring somebody in who was bad like Trey that could just work with him and make him better, which is smart. There's so many former players now that even if you use them in an assistant coach role, like can help teams, could help young stars right now. And also teach them the perils of how your immature young mistakes could be held against you. Young fella, learn from me, young. They need more of those guys in the locker room, those old heads.
No question about it. That's how you learn and figure out how to move in these rooms and these circles of these pros. You know, it's the young fella. They put the arm around you, start talking that stuff, and they just try to give you some game. Here's the thing that I wanted to ask you, and it kind of goes along in this same sort of wheelhouse. It's about mental health. Do you think, like, so mental health can kind of take on a bunch of different faces and shapes. It can be an issue that's personal or a larger one, whatever. But I feel like we define it as a negative too much, right? As far as it in terms of our athletes, where positive mental health isn't necessarily focused on. So just like this point about having a mentor that'll be in your ear, an old head that's trying to teach you positive ways to deal with stuff, cope, whatever it is that you guys are talking about. How come that's not sort of pushed more or talked about more, in particular in the NBA, mentorships that have to do with mental health? You know what I mean?
Well, starting with mentoring, one thing that Kiki Vandeweghe actually acknowledged he made a mistake on was Melo's rookie year. You'll laugh at this story. Melo's rookie year, Camby was on the team.
Yeah, I remember.
But the roster was a lot of young dudes and a lot of dudes that's trying to hang on, right?
Yeah.
And so after one of the practice, Camby goes, yo, it's Junior Harrington's birthday. I don't know if you remember Junior Harrington.
Bro, I was out there, Mark. I went to a mini camp. So I remember Junior. This is when McDice, Rafe, Vashawn Leonard.
This is after.
This is after them? Okay.
No, this is Melo's rookie year.
Oh, this is 03. This is 03. Yeah.
So yeah, when did you go to mini camp with the Nuggets?
So I think it was – so Kiki, Clyde Drexler, Louis Dampier was an
there.
Assistant. So I was there too, bro.
I was there.
I went for like a little mini camp, busted.
You were 54. I remember.
Yeah, Kroenke was around. He was on the bike. Kroenke was on the bike. See,
you don't remember me. I was there.
I know you was. I was there.
But that's dope. That's dope. I need to see some preseason stats.
Yeah, we do.
We were in the powder blues, but so Melo comes in, Junior Harrington's birthday, and after practice, Camby goes, all right, I need all the rookies to sing happy birthday.
Okay.
Melo's like, I ain't singing. And this is when they used to let us in practice. Like, we used to be able to go to like practice the whole time and show up when the players were starting, and I loved it. I hated it, and I loved it because we had to be there for 3 hours. But then I started learning so much more on why certain guys weren't playing, who had a great work ethic, who was lazy, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Melo's like, I ain't singing. And I was thinking, if Melo had gotten drafted by Detroit, and if he would have said that to Banshee, Chance, Rip, Tay, they would have been on his head. Yes, Camby was by himself, right? Because there wasn't really like a lot of veterans on the team.
Oh, yeah.
And he's like, all right, man. And all of a sudden, so the other rookies are singing happy birthday. Melo was beatboxing.
Oh, he making a beat to the beat. Okay.
He was beatboxing happy birthday, okay, right? Okay. So the point of the story is, at that point, I was like, oh, Melo's running the team. He's running the team. Like, if he's basically saying, I ain't doing this, and the vets let it go, then he was running the team. And that was, yeah, like, the biggest mistake the Nuggets had, because Camby was a starter. He didn't have time to worry about Melo, right? Mm-hmm. But they Kiki almost signed LaPhonso Ellis to basically be in the locker room and keep an eye on him, on Melo. Okay. And Melo said he wished that he had some vet that he respected that had that time to kind of like be in his tail, make sure he got in early, left late, worked, kept an eye on him when they went out. Because, you know, the team players typically went out together. He didn't have that. And I think that's why he had a lot of struggles early in his career. And I told him that LaPhonso Ellis story. He's like, man, I wish they would have did bring somebody like that in. So I do think it's important for teams, especially with young stars, to have some older player at the end of their career that could be in there and help and guide them and has time. Camby didn't have time. Camby was trying to live his life. He was in the peak of his career, right? He didn't have time to worry about Melo. Same way. Bean, Kobe. Like, luckily, he had a Byron Scott, but I was around that team a little bit because I was at the LA Daily News. Man, Shaq and them dudes didn't have time for Kobe after practice back then. They was going to Century Club, bro. They didn't have time for him.
The gate, guard the Eaton, and all that.
Like, Nick Quick didn't have time for him. Right? You know what I'm saying? Like,
Eddie Jones and them. Nah. You know,
dudes were still there. They was like, we had these streets. He wasn't 21 yet.
Please.
And you know, in Cali, they look at your age now. They ain't sneaking you in there.
All day. You can't get in.
License. So, but I think it was good for the Lakers that they did have Byron Scott there. And so it's important that every NBA team, I think, which helps a young player stick around, has an old head. To the other part about mental health, I actually think there is better mental health help than there ever has been in the NBA. When you were coming up, when you were trying to make the Nuggets, it didn't exist. Remember, like, the Nuggets did have this guy who was like the brain doctor or something like that.
Well, I dealt with the brain doctor at UCLA. Yeah. He could tell your personality profile just by watching you move.
But but did he really help you? Did he understand what a young black man was going through? Right? No.
It was identification, but it wasn't any type of solutions that were offered. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
But
my point is, every team now, they don't publicize it. Pretty much every team now has their own on-call or full-time psychologist. Several of them are black, which I think is important. So, like, several more black females, which I think the players open up to more. It's like they're talking to their mom, their sister, their aunt. And so I think they have resources now that when you were, you know, getting in the NBA, working on getting an NBA, did not exist. I don't think they really existed 10 years ago, but they do exist now. There is help now if they want it. And that some teams do a much better job than others, but I do think that there is an ability to get help quietly that we probably don't see. I've been wanting to write a story about it, but a lot of these teams don't want their people to talk.
Well, it's a delicate subject, probably, you know, as far as that type of thing. But I do like the fact that they are making steps to address, and at least there's resources. Because if you remember back in our day when we hooped, it was a major stigma associated with mental health. And it was something that, you know, you guys wouldn't want to talk about, especially you going through stuff. Like, well, I used to go.
Black men in particular, like, we,
you know, because we already, you already don't.
Bro, you know how many of us had PTSD from just, like, things they saw growing up.
Yes, man.
In the streets.
It's a real thing, man.
Yeah,
And to cope on our own, to be able to cope without this stuff, it speaks to the character resiliency and, like, you know, we still be trying to do the right thing. That's the craziest part of it
all. We laugh and tell these stories now, but, oh, man, they had this drive-by or I was in this club and these dudes started fighting.
It's like, man.
It sounds funny to talk about it now or some of the gang stuff you saw growing up in L.A.
Yeah, it was wild.
Like, shoot, man, I remember being in high school and getting chased by five dudes from East Palo Alto and had hide in the gas station to keep from getting beat up. The funny
story Bob Myers always tells us back at UCLA was like, yeah, man, my dad dropped me off at this court in East Palo Alto and I had to go hoop. And it was like one of the craziest experiences he had, but he gained some respect. So I understand what East Palo Alto is all about, bro.
Yeah.
There was one time we got, you know, because we used to drive around to different parks, you know, five us at a time, two cars, you know what I'm saying, and go get the runs in.
In L.A.
Yo, you had to be deep. You had to have a lot of people with you. And you had to be, you know, you couldn't really run your mouth like that because you never knew who had something on them or what, you know. So
your dad taught us in the movie. The white man can't jump about running about.
He's going to go get his other gun. Oh, man, that was hilarious. But, man, staying on that sort of mental health, I wanted to get your take. This is somebody that works in the league, covered the league for so long. So you've watched sort of the evolution of this. Cannabis use amongst NBA players as a way to cope with different aches and pains when they're not comfortable to deal with traditional medicines, etc. I know the league, they banned it in what, 99? And then along with the dress code to sort of reshift the image of the NBA, but now it's at a different place. What are your thoughts on the cannabis subject?
In the bubble.
Oh, I heard. Hey, I heard, bro.
Man, I think I went into towards the final days of the bubble when a lot of the teams, most of the teams were eliminated. There was a big old package of weed that was like a box full of weed that somebody just didn't pick up.
Oh my goodness. It was just stanking up the whole downstairs.
It was well packaged. You know what I mean? Dude. Like, you couldn't smell anything, but you knew what it was.
Absolutely.
Like, man, look, man, I'm not somebody that smokes weed, and I never have.
True.
But I live in Cali, and anybody but I love a glass of wine. I think you know that.
Oh yeah.
So who am I to tell somebody not to smoke weed, right? Like, my weed friends, wine is more dangerous. And I'm like, bro, smoke your weed. That makes you feel good.
Tripping.
Do it, man. Like, I think we're in a progressive state. Like, we've always, like,
a lot different than the rest of the world.
We hadn't thought twice about weed since in the 90s, bro. Since Dr. Mm-mm. Dre came Mm-mm. out. You know what I'm saying? Like, we don't care.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
Nah, so it's kind of like funny, that, like, man. It's still a big deal now. Like,
yeah.
And it's funny because now it's called cannabis. We call it cannabis.
All right. Well, they had to change the name.
You know,
they had to change it and make better. It sound.
Do you remember?
Yeah, cannabis.
Cannabis. It's cannabis. We have cannabis delivery. I see these billboards. I'm like, nah, y'all got some people. Y'all arrested all these brothers for selling weed on the corner.
Weed, okay? Yeah. Like Stephen A. Smith say, weed! Yeah, stay off the weed, bro!
All these brothers went to jail for selling weed, but now you legally can deliver cannabis to somebody's house.
Like, come on, man. Like, come on, man.
Let them brothers out of jail, right?
Absolutely.
But it's, I think it's funny because I actually, you see if you remember this. Remember when Melo got in trouble for bringing weed on a plane when he was with Denver?
Oh, man, yeah, I do.
And
I do.
He had a backpack that had some weed in it, and he had this dude named Slim that took the rap for him because he said it was Slim's backpack. I've been wanting to talk to Melo about this because this is like funny to me. It's funny now. Well, it was like this big deal, but Melo had weed in his bag and some dude named Slim. I think Slim got a nice check, you know, took the rap, which is like now you think about it, it was just silly. It was stupid. Like he had some weed in his bag and then now he has a weed company. But it was funny, like, 15 years ago, Melo basically almost went to dang jail for having weed in his bag, and now he's making money off it.
And it's amazing to see all the athletes that are involved on the cannabis side on the professional level that are making money off of it.
That's good.
I know Al Harrington, Steven Jackson, AI, Matt Barnes, you know, yeah, these guys are advocates. They're advocates and for the right reason. When you hear them talk about it, man, you really get an understanding that they really take it serious and they're really concerned about, you know, the health benefits.
And I'm glad they're making money off of it, man.
As they should.
I'm glad they're experts.
Tried and tested, okay?
Hey, they don't even have to go like learn about it. They don't need to go to no class. They know.
They've been known.
They can tell you anything you want to know about any kind.
Oh man, that's so
they
funny.
Know more about weed than they do hoop.
I know.
Which is saying a lot.
That'd be the crazy part, but yeah, more power
but shout
to
out
those
to guys. Al Harrington, who was way ahead of the game.
He's been ahead of it. He's killing it. Yeah.
And I hope that any NBA player who decides to invest in something, man, invest in Al.
Yeah.
Invest in one of your guys, man. Like,
absolutely. Absolutely.
Like AI did. I'm glad AI teamed up with him.
Yeah, he locked in. Yeah. Mark, I wanted to get an understanding of why you went back to school and decided to get your master's degree in sports management. I know you graduated from LSU in 2019. Why did you do that? You're already established, you know, so why would you add that to your repertoire?
You know, one of my favorite sayings I got from former Nuggets head coach Jeff Buzdelic is always stay two steps ahead of the posse.
Mm.
And I kind of felt like I don't like just standing still. I always want to better myself. My mom has a master's degree. My sister has a master's degree. I don't like them being ahead of me either. So I got an AA degree from Foothill College. I got a bachelor's from San Jose State. And I've always wanted to have one, but I wanted to better myself. So how could I not only get my master's, but better myself in the process? And I thought that in my line of work, learning more about the business of sports than I already did know, certainly could benefit me. So that's why I decided to go into sports business management. Believe it or not, I actually tried to go to Columbia for a second.
Okay.
And just a right or wrong from high school. And
they
got me in, but it was like I had to take the GRE and it was expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, my family's from Louisiana. My parents live in New Orleans. I always had New Orleans ties and loved LSU and the Tigers. And, spent summers in Bunny Friend Park in New Orleans and, you know, the Seventh Ward and the Ninth Ward and, you know.
Oh, you in the thick of it.
Best of gumbo and, you know,
eating,
you don't even know what Huckapuck is. You know what Huckapuck is?
Nah, I don't know what Huckapuck is.
It's like the Dixie Cups and they used to put Kool-Aid in them and freeze them and the white lady used to sell them for 10 cents and we used to go get the Huckapuck. So, like, I have a lot of people think I'm from New Orleans. I'm from the Bay.
Okay.
Like, I could tell you how to get to Chapultepec Street. Like, New Orleans is my second home, right?
Yeah.
And so I just started talking to the LSU people, and they had this great sports business program. And they're like, yo, with your experience, they waived the GRE for me, which was like, cool.
That's love. That's love.
Yeah, like, they wanted me to be a part. Like, they recruited me.
Mm-hmm.
LSU, like, recruited me to be a part of it, to be a part of their program. And, man, it was a great 2 years. Shout out to Professor Martinez, man. I learned a lot. And, man, the football program has, like, embraced me. The basketball program has embraced me. They sent me swag.
That's the best
now,
part.
Now, San Jose State football has embraced me, too. And they still love me at San Jose State. But I got – and Foothill College, they got some – like, all of them take care of me. But LSU, like, embraced me as a family. And I learned a lot, so
that's dope.
I thought that there's going to be a day when perhaps I don't do this anymore. Maybe a team might want me to work for them, or a league might want me to work for them in a senior role, or I could be a professor. So as you know, like, I can't teach at UCLA without a master's, right? I can't teach at San Jose State without a master's. So it's me trying to stay two steps ahead of the posse. And that's why I wanted to get my master's degree. And it wasn't easy. It was hard. But I was so proud when I got it. And, you know, I ended up I went to the ceremony, even though I did it online. I went to Baton Rouge with my mom, and she was really proud, and my now wife, we went. And, you know, it's funny, yeah. Like, we get there. I'll tell you the story real quick. And I'm driving up, and this brother comes up to the window, and he goes, "What's up, man? How you doing, man?" I'm like, "Hey, man." He goes, "Mark, you don't remember me. I met you at the All-Star game in New Orleans. You were really, really nice to me." I was like, "Oh, okay, good. Good to see you." He's like, "Yo, I work in the LSU football department. You want to come in and take pictures in your cap and gown in the locker room?"
Oh, in the football locker room?
Yeah.
Oh.
He said, "We got recruits in. You know how the recruits be taking all those pictures and stuff." He's like, yeah. "You could take them with your cap and gown." Yeah. Like, yeah, I'm supposed to be standing in line getting ready for graduation. Bruh, I go into Tiger Stadium, go in the locker room. You know how like all the players take the recruiting, like I'm in the lockers. Yeah. I'm by these footballs. Yeah. It's like, oh, it's purple and yellow. You know what I'm saying?
Sick.
And
that
then I'm taking all these pictures and like, I got to go get ready for the graduation. He goes, "You don't want to go on the field?" I'm like, "What do you mean?" He's like, "You could take some pictures on the field."
Dang.
So,
Death Valley.
Man, I came out. There's video of it. I hit the wind bar. I'm in my cap and gown.
Yeah.
I go on the field at Tiger Stadium by myself.
God, that's wild.
They take pictures of me. We walk back in. Guess who's standing there? Ed Orgeron.
Jeez.
So, I mean, he had no idea who I am. Probably
still okay.
It was just fine. You don't need to know who I am. He meets my mom. And they start talking about my mom is a saint, but I think she lied. She told Ed Orgeron, "I pray for you before every game." I look at her like, "You do?
You do?
You pray for LSU football before every game, Ma."
Oh, that's funny.
I'm going to go with it. And she said, "Yeah, you do." She's like, "You a Christian woman?" She's like, "Yeah." They start talking religion, and Ed Orgeron and my mom walk onto the football field, start having this long conversation about religion.
Wow.
I'm like, "I got to graduate."
Like, mom, come back.
No, I left her with Ed Orgeron on the football field and took off.
And you ain't graduated.
And they ended up watching it and everything. I don't know how much longer she talked to him.
Oh, that was
dope,
her,
Ed Orgeron. Don't say nothing about Ed O now.
No, that's a great story. That's a great story.
Yeah, but man. LSU has showed me a lot of love, but they showed me love with their education, and I feel like I know a lot more about the business of basketball, about the business of sports.
Yeah.
And, like, it's funny when we talk about we want to get the teams moving and stuff like that, but I start breaking down to my friends, like, why this makes sense, why this doesn't make sense, TV markets and revenue sharing and all that. I'm like, damn.
You on it. Oh, yeah.
I got my masters in this, dog.
Hey, come on, bro.
Yeah.
Love it. I love to hear it, Mark. Man, that was a great story. So, man, we're about an hour in, man. I just got really one more comment from you, bro, that I wanted to grab. And I ask everybody that I've interviewed over the last 6 months the same question. It's been about 75 different interviews. If you could, just share with us your most memorable story about Kobe Bryant.
Wow. Well, there's some I can't put on.
The ones we can share. The ones we can. PG-13.
Can I tell two?
Yes, please. Please do.
One time, I went to interview him, and he took care. He used to take care of me, Chris, man. Like, I would, me and him talk via email. And I'm big on email. Because players change their phone numbers all the time, but they don't change their emails. That's a little gift for the journalism people listening. They don't change their emails. So I'd email him, "Hey, I'm coming to town. I'm coming to practice." I would go to media day, and he would always – he'd talk to everybody, but then he would put me on the side for 10 minutes. Mm-hmm. And I remember all the media people would be looking at me pissed and everything.
Right.
Don't hate the player, hate the game. Game used to take care of me, man.
Word,
he used to give me some great one-on-one interviews. And mm-hmm. – So one time he was with my man Nico Harrison. Shout out to Nico. Congrats on the Dallas job. Him and Nico, as Nico was always by his side. They're leaving practice, and I'm at a practice, and I go to interview Bean. I said, "Kobe, you got a couple minutes before you leave?" And he said, no, not for you today. I'm like, what are you talking about? Bro, I had this beautiful Adidas sweatsuit on. Like, head to toe.
What, the velour?
Like, you know, we like big dudes, so
yeah,
it's
so
hard
you know
to
how
get something that fit right.
Yep.
You know, but it was this, it was this black Adidas sweatsuit with the black shoes to match. I was looking good that day.
Fly.
And it fit right. It was almost like it was tailor-made. It fit that good.
Oh, he's like, that.
I ain't doing an interview with you wearing that. Oh, and I'm like, why? He's like, really, dog? And he's Nike drip head to toe. And it hit me like, damn, he did have a bad breakup with Adidas. And I'm like, he's like, I'm just not doing that. And I needed this interview bad. I'm like, come on, man. He's like, look, this is what you're going to do. I said, what's that? You're going to go, I'm going to give you the interview, but when you go home, you're going to throw all that away, and you're going to take a video of you throwing it away. And you
No.
Yes.
I don't
know. I want to see it in the trash, that sweatsuit in the trash.
What?
And I need proof that you threw it away. Do you want the interview or not? And I was like, yeah, bro, I want the interview. So I did the interview. And literally, when I went home, I had somebody videotape me throwing it down the trash chute.
So you
wasn't
really
even like a trash can; it was a trash chute because I lived in an apartment in Jack London.
So you was done. So that was it for it. So that was it. It wasn't coming back.
No, it was in a trash chute. You didn't want going in that trash. It was for an apartment complex trash.
How did that make Mark? How did
and
that
the
make
shoes
you feel
too?
But how did that make you feel? Was it worth it, Mark?
Yes.
At the end of the day.
Yes. For any Bean interview at that time.
Yes, sir.
And yes, sir. What I learned from that is there's another little journalism tip. Anytime I interview a player, I either put my cold hands on, because cold hands is like, remember South Central or the hood, like East Side, San Jose, East EPA, you better know what colors are in different neighborhood.
Oh, yeah.
But
if
you wore white, if some like you blue could. Jeans, you could probably get away anywhere,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
blue jeans are blue jeans, right?
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
So my point is I would wear shoes or clothing that if I talk to Curry, I'm wearing Under Armour. Like if I'm talking to Dame, I wear Adidas.
Adidas.
And if I talk to Draymond Durant, I wear Nike. Like I wear it based on who I'm talking to. Because I learned my one lesson. And if you think these dudes is not following that,
you got another thing coming.
You got another thing coming. So now that's the lesson I learned from that. Like I'm very like I interviewed CP yesterday, but I had Kohans on, so I was neutral, right?
Yeah,
I was dressed up,
suited and booted.
Them dudes pay attention to that.
Yeah, they do.
The only other story I'll tell. We got time, or you got to run?
Yeah, we got plenty of time, bro.
So when he played his last game at Golden State, I was at the game. And he saw me waiting for him in a locker room. You know that Golden State locker room, you visiting locker room at that time was like the biggest in the league. It's huge.
Yep.
For visiting team, it's huge.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And he goes, somebody came up to me and said, Kobe said to come in the training room. I ain't never been in no training room like a media person, but if Kobe said to come in the training room, take your butt to the training room.
I'm going to the training room.
And we have like this long conversation. And the one thing about him, if you was one of his people, that I loved about him is he really cared about you as a person and cared how you were doing and how your family was doing. And I think the first time we really were able to connect was after Hurricane Katrina. And he played, if somebody wants to look it up, there's this great game on YouTube that you could probably find now, where it was a charity game for Hurricane Katrina that took place in Houston. All these NBA superstars played in it. Kobe, Shaq.
It was on TNT.
Kenny Smith.
It was on TNT.
And I remember. Chauncey played in it. Iverson, like all of them was in it. And that's when me and Kobe connected, because he actually pulled me to the side and was asking me about my family and my parents who had evacuated. So we had this long conversation, and
he actually asked you about that.
Yeah,
he asked
like
you
pulled
about
me
that?
Aside, and he heard my family was in New Orleans, like literally asked me about how they were doing and stuff like that. So, anyways, fast forward at that time, kind of felt like something was changing with my career. The undefeated stuff was slowly starting to come up, and I kind of gave him a heads up on it. And after I got the job, he was one of the first people I emailed because we had a real, I was actually worried about our conversation getting on air because that's when Spike Lee was filming all that stuff for his documentary. And they were, the camera crew was in the room when me and him spoke. Now, I would love to have that video personally now, if I could, about that conversation. I wish that if you ever run across somebody who worked on that doc, I bet you they could probably find it deep in the archives. But we talked for about 15 minutes. But I sent him an email, basically told him I got the job. And he sent me an email back saying, hey, man, I'm proud of you. Continue to use your voice. And if you need anything from me, man, don't hesitate. And I've been meaning to print out that email and like put it on this wall somewhere.
As you know,
I need to do that. But the last time I saw him was about a year after I was in the undefeated. When he got his jersey retired, that was not the last time I saw him, but the last time we got to speak.
I remember. I think you got the video of that.
Yeah,
right?
he came up to me. Is that Big Spears? Yeah. Is that Big Spears?
Yeah.
And
I love that
video. He actually was congratulating me for my career and what I was doing with the undefeated. And I'm like, bro, you see me? I'm like, you just retired, like your jersey. This is about you.
Yeah,
tonight.
Yeah.
This ain't about me, but that showed you what kind of man he was, that he hadn't seen me. We had emailed or talked, whatever, but and done interviews and everything on, but we hadn't seen each other. And he was like, hey, man, congratulations. And I was like, even in this time of getting his jersey retired, he thought it was important to tell me congratulations, man. So I'm still not there with it yet. You know what I mean? I still haven't figured it out yet in my mind. I was sad when he retired. I think that was the only time when a player retired that I was like, damn. He was great. He was great to me. And then him being gone, I still haven't come to like a complete realization about that.
No, that's one of the toughest things that we've had to deal with, man. Like, as a basketball community, bro.
Yeah,
like,
yeah, that ain't going away.
Yeah. Oh, no, man. It's deep. It's too deep.
You go to L.A., and y'all got a reminder on every corner.
Yeah, I can't even. Yeah, you can't walk anywhere without thinking about
any neighborhood in L.A. That's love, too.
Major love.
Any neighborhood in L.A., you're going to see a mural. Yeah, some are better than others.
Yeah. Some resemble Kobe a little more than others.
Yeah.
But man, it's funny though when you talk to people and how all these stories about Kobe's character, the unbelievable nature of his character, are now starting to come out. It makes you realize that the Black Mamba, his on-court persona, that whole thing, that was just really what it was.
Well, but no, that was work ethic.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
That was like work ethic. When you saw Jordan the Last Dance, like come to tears, like that was like the moment of the Last Dance I always remember, because he wanted greatness so much that in order to get it out of other people, he felt like he had to be a jerk to get them to respond. And that a lot of that was in Kobe too. Like I could imagine the conversations that Jordan and Kobe had late at night, because I don't know that anybody really, they had anybody else to relate to that mentality, that Mamba mentality, that Jordan-esque mentality, like that I want greatness at all costs. I know you're not as great as me, but I'm going to push and prod you to bring you to a place that you didn't think you could get to. And so it was funny because so many people thought that Bean was a jerk and that, oh my goodness, he was one of the greatest people in the world, like smartest people in the world. Another thing he did behind the scenes that was brilliant, and I implore any NBA player, especially the stars, to do this. One of the reasons, I mean, being in LA affords you treasures, right? you're going to meet people wearing that Laker uniform and forge you treasures. But when he would go meet with people after games, it was always these influential people. He would scout them in the same way he scouted their opponents. So if you were so-and-so from Microsoft and you got to meet Kobe after the game, because the only people he was meeting after game were either people that, you know, kids who something tough was happening with them, right? Or somebody of ilk, somebody of note, like got to meet him. And you would see these people several times after Lakers game. You see these like very important people, like nervous. He would come in and be like, oh, hey, so-and-so, pleasure to meet you, man. Oh, man, what you doing with Microsoft is amazing. Yeah, you guys did this, this, and this, and this. And that's like, so he was like calming them down, taking away the nervousness, because they would be shocked, like, damn, you know as much about me as I do about you. And I'm sure that opened all kind of business doors for him.
Absolutely.
Because once he was meeting all these powerful people and showing them respect and knowing who they were, hey, man, Kobe, whatever you want, you call me, have your people call me, and that door will open. There was so much great that he was going to do that I think would have surpassed everything he did. Legendary already. Like the book that he had written, he wrote about superheroes. Like, who writes about superheroes of different races? Because his kids were mixed, he wanted them to be able to read books about, you know, superheroes or mythical characters that were of different colors so they could relate to them. I wish we could have heard him talk about race today. I wish we could have heard him during all this hate. And you'd have all these, like, the people that are racist, but they'll listen to Kobe Bryant. Like, I think his best work would have been done now.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, he didn't get a chance to do that.
No, but yeah, he didn't. But it's up to the next generation of men to kind of keep it up. I know for me personally, just being a dad and having daughters and just watching him with his little girls and just that whole side of him. I mean, it really just, it sort of just disarms you in a sense, because, you know, you're used to him as this certain dude, but you see him with, you know, Natalia and Gianna and how he talks about him. And so it just makes you be like, man, I got to be a better dude. And it's not a lot of people that inspire you, especially when you get to my age anymore. Like, I don't have as many inspirations, but I will say that Kobe Bryant as a man, not basketball player, but as a man, he definitely was one of the most inspirational dudes that I had, you know, because I was off of him for a little bit, but then I just had no choice but to be like, man, this dude is just, you know, melting my
sharp
heart.
As a tack. Always, he took a lot of things from Michael, suited and booted after the game. And you saw the love for his family, because he was like one of the few players, and perhaps it was because of his star too, that he could do it. Like, you would see often when he's leaving the game, his wife and kids would be sitting outside the locker room waiting on him.
Always.
And you know the love for him, because they were patient about it. It wasn't like they were waiting in the family room for him. They were waiting outside the locker room for him.
Wow. That's dope, man.
So I saw them little girls all the time, because they were waiting. They would sit there and wait for him for a half hour or whatever. You know, he was one of the last people to walk out. Things he had to do. But man, that's
yep.
There were so many beautiful chapters to be written that was stolen from the world.
Absolutely. Well, Mark, man, I appreciate you, your time today.
Hold on, I'm gonna leave with this, because we gotta leave on a good note.
Let's leave on a good note, bro.
Yeah, he used to always tell me I asked a lot of Dr. Seuss ass questions.
What do you mean by, like, you come with the riddles? You come in with the riddles?
I took it as a compliment, man, because, you know, like, I also, like, minored in psychology. So my questions have depth to them a lot of times. And he said, man, you always ask me all these damn Dr. Seuss-ass questions, man. Like, so I refuse to think of it as a put down. I do think it was a compliment, man. But
that's hilarious. Dr. Seuss-ass questions.
You always ask some goddamn Dr. Seuss-ass questions.
One of a kind, my man.
Yes, sir. Bing, man. Yep.
Yes. Rest in peace.
Rest in peace, brother.
I appreciate you, my man. Thank you for coming on KJ Live today, and man, I hope we can do this.
Thanks for bringing on some, you know, just journalists, man. Like, you know, yeah, I don't know if anybody cares what I have to say.
Yeah, they do. They do. You got the voice. You got a voice, man. You're one of the most interesting dudes, man. And I love your work. Keep up the great work, bro. I'm a big, big fan, man. And it's been an honor to have you on the show, man. I appreciate it. Hey,
love you. Love your family. Yes, y'all, sir. Basketball royalty. Keep doing everything you guys are doing on all platforms.
I appreciate you.
You, man. Your brother. Yeah. Y'all define what basketball means, man. So I love you all. Love you. Continue success, bro.
Thank you, Mark. I appreciate you, man.